Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, where we take on serious issues, generally with a panel, one issue at a time. Today, the issue is something that we haven't been paying attention to in our society, the environmental movement. And the question is, has there ever been an environmental movement in America? And the failures of the big green organizations. Which of those organizations, and why am I concerned about them? Because it is my belief, having been in the environmental movement my entire life, written a very important book on it, producing now for over 7 years, a documentary on the 12 tipping points, having helped be a part of many environmental movements, including the anti-fracking movement, the anti-nuclear movement, the anti-genetic engineering movement, I have to ask defenders of wildlife, the Environmental Defense Fund, the National Audubon Society, the National Wildlife Federation, the National Resource Defense Council, the National Conservancy, the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, and the World Wildlife Fund, where have you been? What are we seeing from your organizations that shows us that you're willing to go up against Democrat and Republicans, White House, whether it's conservative or liberal? Were you able to be out there in the demonstrations? Because for a long time now, I haven't seen you at these rallies. I haven't seen you asking for national moratoriums. I haven't seen it. Now, if I'm missing something good, then we'll find out today. My two panelists to take us on this journey, beginning with Thomas Lindsay, L-I-N-Z-E-Y. He's an attorney and the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which is a nonprofit firm that provides free legal services to over 500 local governments and nonprofit organizations. He is a cum laude graduate of Widener Law School and a three-time recipient of the law school's Public Interest Law Award. He also is an author. He has taught in 24 states around the country. And he is also the co-founder of the Daniel Pinnock Democracy School. He is the author of Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community. He can be heard co-hosting Democracy Matters, a public radio program broadcast on KYRS in Spokane. He'll be our first panelist, followed by Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen has become one of the nation's leading voices of cultural and environmental dissent. He writes on how civilization is devastating the environment and the natural world, and our society's denial of that fact. Hutney Reader listed Derek as among the 50 visionaries changing the world, in sharp contrast to environmental optimists who believe working within the corporate system will offset the tenuous planetary balance threatened by climate change. Derek has advocated for many years a dismantling of civilization, which can include radical dissent as well as imparting wisdom to our children. He has received many awards for his writings, including two Endgame volumes, and his most recent book is Dreams. It's a critique against the fundamentalist Christian legalist morality and the materialist of the scientific community that define Western civilization and reinforce their disregard and violence against nature. He also is a former rep for a genetically modified seed company, Pioneer, but supporting Monsanto with land to grow GMOs for biofuels, and he also challenges them. He lives in Northern California. First, let's go over and say hello to our guest, Thomas Lindsay. Nice to have you with us tonight,
nice
Thomas.
Nice to have you with us today, Thomas.
Yes, so thanks for having us on the show, Gary.
Let me give you the larger overview, and let us address this. For many years, I took a careful look at what we were doing for the environment, and I saw major groups that were advocating on behalf of the American citizen. But then one day, there was a photo in one of the papers showing some of the heads of these environmental groups who had had lunch with the Vice President, Al Gore, and were throwing a football with him, and I said, well, there goes the environmental movement. And someone says, what do you mean? I said, Clinton and Gore come across as kind of your best friend people that wear the jeans, they hang out, they're cool, they're educated, they come from that elite background. Surely they're on our side, meaning They care about our water, our soil. They're not going to be supporting genetic engineering. They're going to want to take what Ralph Nader and other environmentalists did to help our environment, and they're going to take it forward. And then over the years that Clinton was in the White House, I saw at least 40 major decisions made that were not widely publicized or publicized at all that actually adversely affected the environment. And especially all the environmental degradation with the opening up of our major public land for exploitation in the old hardwood forest and wanting to weaken the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act. And then I started to do my own investigation, and it just led me to see that most of these major environmental groups were really about themselves. It's much like the Haiti earthquake. We all saw the pain and suffering. We all felt it. We wanted to help. And indeed, people poured about $3 billion into guarantees, governments and individuals, to help them. The trouble is, I have friends who are working on the ground in Haiti, and they say, that money never got here. You know, you don't see anyone who's really helped. But where did that money go? Well, it went to a lot of these, you know, NGOs, these nonprofit governmental organizations that always had the nice offices. And now the environmental movement is the same. It has great offices, the top ones at least, lots of money, and lobbyists. They have a lot of former politicians on advisories. But the question is, why is it our environment isn't being improved? Why is it that we have pollution in the Pacific Ocean of just plastic three times the size of Texas? No one's doing anything. Why is it the largest polluter in the United States is the U.S. Armed Forces, the Defense Department, and no one's challenging it, not even talking about it? And how about the pollution in space? Why aren't we talking about that? And why aren't we talking about depleted uranium that we're using? And why aren't we talking about nuclear power and closing it down? And look at our water supply, and look at we're past peak water. Look at our soil. So when I look at the totality of everything that's going on that's bad with our environment, unfortunately, I do not see that we have made any major progress through Defenders of the Wildlife, the Environmental Defense Fund, the National Audubon Society, the National Wildlife Federation, the Natural Resource Defense Council, the Nature Conservancy, the Wildlife Society, and the World Wildlife Fund, all of these. I don't see where we are safer, better, healthier in our environment because of them. Now, maybe I'm missing something, and if I am, I want to be instructed on this. Instead, I see these people collectively making and spending hundreds of millions of dollars over the years, some $500 million in 1 year, one group alone. And then I say, where do you stand? Are you for or against nuclear? And if you're against it, what have you done? Because I haven't seen you when we were at Indian Point this past Sunday. I didn't see you when we were picketing the governor's office in Manhattan with 2,000 of us. I didn't see you against gas hydrofracking. I didn't see you against the giant wind turbines that are 400 feet in the air that destroy the environment that they're in, supposedly bring clean, you know, electricity, but really are nothing more than T. Boone Pickens' major cartel with Goldman Sachs to squeeze more money into their pockets and destroy local environments. Where are these people? I mean, I'd like to know what the hell they've done. That's my opinion. I'd like to turn it over to you to take us through this step by step.
Sure. I think the questions that you ask are very good ones, which a lot of people started to ask after spending a lot of their lives doing the same kind of environmental activism that the major environmental groups have done. And in fact, it's a journey that we came through because we started as a law firm doing conventional environmental work, sometimes hand in hand with some of those organizations that you mentioned. At this point, I refer to myself as a recovering environmental lawyer. As someone who did that work in the past, came to certain conclusions about it, some of the same conclusions that you've arrived at as well, and have begun doing a different kind of work, which to us, the real environmental work being done today is actually being done by communities and municipalities. So at the local level, these folks are starting to do things like ban fracking in communities or ban corporate factory farms in their municipalities, doing things that you're not going to find the large conventional environmental organizations doing. In fact, we refer to the large environmental groups in Washington, D.C. as gangrene, because they're the green gang that hangs out, and gangrene, of course, raises other connotations. But we when we go out on the stump as an environmental, we still call ourselves an environmental law firm, assisting communities to protect their land and their families and their municipalities from these types of corporate projects. We make a somewhat controversial statement many times, which is that there's never been an environmental movement in the United States. And the reason why we make that statement is because the environmental movement in the United States has never been about rights for ecosystems or nature. It's been about a property-based environmental protection system in which if you own a 10-acre parcel of land, the deed to that land carries with it the legal authority for you to destroy the ecosystems on that parcel of land. So it's not just that the environmental organizations have received money from corporations. In fact, just recently it was disclosed that the Sierra Club took $25 million from Chesapeake Energy, which is a big fracking advocate in the United States. It's not just because of the money that's come in. It's not just because the environmental groups have cozied up with the inside the beltway politicians and political system. It's that they've been doing their work under the wrong system. And the system under which they've been doing work is this property-based environmental protection system. And there's a reason why 40 years after the major environmental laws are passed in this country that things are worse now by almost every major environmental statistic than they were 40 years ago. It's because that system of regulation and permitting simply doesn't work because its main focus is not on protecting the environment, but actually permitting some of the largest corporations in the land to make decisions about transportation policy and waste management policy and agricultural policy, while the environmental groups pretty much stand on the sidelines and try to beg and plead the corporations to cause a little less harm to the communities. In other words, we're not the ones in charge, and the environmental groups have made careers out of cozying up with the folks who are in charge without questioning for the moment why those folks are in charge of making these key fundamental decisions rather than community majorities making those decisions. And so, you know, movements in this country, whether it be the suffragists or the abolitionists or prior people's movements of other ilk in the United States, have always been about taking things that were considered property under the law and transforming them into rights-based entities or rights-based people. So, for example, the abolitionists took African Americans as slaves, which were treated as property, and actually transformed them into rights-bearing, rights-possessing people under the law through the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments to the Constitution. The suffragists did the same, which was taking women from having status as property under the Constitution to actually transforming them into rights-based people. In other words, transforming them into persons under the law. We've never had an environmental movement because it's never actually set its sights on recognizing ecosystems in nature as having rights of their own, inalienable and fundamental rights of their own, but instead that those rights are only derivative of the humans that actually use those ecosystems. So environmental law is built that way today, which is that unless you have a resource use or an exploitation use of an ecosystem, you don't even have standing to sue or standing to raise issues about pollution of that ecosystem under the federal environmental laws. And so it's all property-based, it's all ownership-based, it's all resource-based. And that's why in many ways, things are worse now than they were 40 years ago. What's heartening to me is that many communities across the United States that are faced with fracking, faced with nuclear power, faced with corporate factory farms, faced with sewage sludge being dumped on land, faced with the thousands of different issues that our communities are faced with every day, are actually beginning to adopt laws that recognize that ecosystems and nature have fundamental rights of their own within these communities, and that residents of the community can step into the shoes of the ecosystems to actually defend nature and ecosystems on their own right. So about 36 communities in the United States have passed those kinds of laws. And back in 2008, we were brought into the country of Ecuador because Ecuadorians who were rewriting their constitution in that country heard about these 36 municipalities in the United States that have been doing this work and actually asked us to help them draft new provisions that would make Ecuador the first country in the world to transform from a property-based environmental protection system to a rights-based system. We assisted them to write that. It went to citizen vote back in 2008, overwhelmingly ratified. And now, just a couple months ago, you have the first couple of cases that have been brought under those provisions in Ecuador, in which, for example, a river in Ecuador has become the plaintiff in a lawsuit, the Vilcabamba River in the province of Loja in Ecuador. And just a couple weeks ago, a judge ruled in favor of the river. So you have cases in which the river is the plaintiff and its interests are being protected by the residents who live in the municipality, who are then bringing those interests to bear in the courts to do what we would call real environmental protection, which assumes that ecosystems and nature have rights of their own that we can step in and protect. And so that's what's heartening to me now. But whether it's the major environmental organizations in the United States, which have fought that new emergence of environmental law that's focused on ecosystem and natural communities protection, or in Ecuador, where some of the main environmental groups actually fought us to keep that language out of the Ecuadorian constitution, it's no surprise to us at this point that the environmental laws have devolved to where they are today in the United States, which is essentially nothing less than a permitting system for corporations to do what they want to do with these various projects, and a systematic divesting of any authority at the local level to actually protect the threatened ecosystems that are being endangered by those corporate projects coming in. So that's where we come at things, and we started doing that different kind of law to assist communities to protect their natural environment.
I appreciate those overview, Thomas. Thomas, I'd like a little shorter answers on the following areas, if you would, please. But I'm going to try to tie some of them in. First, I want to pull back, because sometimes we can get so close to an issue that we don't see its interconnectivity to other issues. For example, NASA has told us that we can expect, within the next 12 to 14 months, a major solar storm. Now, we have them on a regular basis, but this is a big one. How big, we don't know. Will it be as bad as the Carrington 1859 storm, which virtually fried the lines in the United States? Could be. Let's hope it's not. But many people, including astrophysicists and others, say it's entirely possible. So I've written articles on it. We've done broadcasts on it. Now, why is this important? Because if the storm is as bad as it, some say it could be, then it could knock out the power grids around the United States, at least many of them. And we have 104 nuclear facilities in the United States that need power. And they're all in rivers or by the ocean because they draw about Indian Point, about 30 miles north of New York City, draws approximately 2.4 billion gallons of water into those cooling systems and then puts radioactive water back out into the Hudson. It kills about 1 to 2 billion fish a year. But when was the last time you heard anything about this by any of the major environmental groups? Now, let's just say then that everyone wakes up and they go to work, and then one moment, boom, there's a solar storm. We don't know it. And then all of our electricity's gone, all of it. No telephones, no computers, no elevators, no gas pumps, water, flushing, nothing works. It means that as soon as the backup fuel in the, more often than not, the diesel generator, which probably will last about a week at a nuclear power plant, when that runs out, the plant may shut down, which is good, but the cooling pool where all the spent fuel rods, which is about 2 to 5 times more outside in these cooling pools than inside in the active reactor, that's going to explode. You're going to run out of water, and just like Fukushima, you're going to see it pop. When it does, in New York, within 5 hours, 20 million people living within 50 miles of New York will be exposed to radiation, including plutonium. But there's no way to fix it at that point. There's no way to replace it because this is not a down power line. This is a fried 100-ton overhead and or major power grid. And they're made in China and they're made in India. So the power grid is going to go down. Nuclear facilities will be affected, but whether or not we're trying to get them to have backup surge protectors, backup fuel for at least a year, they're not doing that now. Power utility companies don't want to put the money into it. So this is very much an environmental issue, because it directly impacts the environment, and with that, people's health. In fact, I don't know of anything that could happen right now to as many people that could be as bad as if nuclear facilities lost power and then radiation started to spew forth. That, at the very least, should call forth all environmental groups to work collectively to show the truth about nuclear and how deadly it is and all the lies that we've been fed over the years. And my film, Knock on the Devil's Door, explores that. But no nuclear major groups have come up to help us. Secondly, we've been advocating at the local level with grassroots. We had only grassroots support. There's myself, Harvey Wasserman, and many others who were up there. We brought in people from Fukushima. But there were about 11 small groups, generally with no more than $1.50 in their bank account, but they're community-based. And so we filled the whole area in front of Indian Point, and we had a whole discussion, lecture, but not a single member of the mainstream environmental groups are there. Well, I'd like to know what is a more important issue than nuclear if we have an accident. All it takes is one Fukushima at any of the plants, because they're all of these nuclear facilities are right close to major urban areas. But it's as if it doesn't exist. Then we find out how many of these environmental groups got money from nuclear power plant company owners, and how many got money from coal companies and gas companies. And then suddenly, those are no longer important issues to them. Well, what is an important issue? Gas hydrofracking was proven today to have caused the earthquakes in Ohio. And we also believe in England and in Oklahoma. So we now can connect, and we have good science behind it, gas hydrofracking, pollution of water, gas hydrofracking, the using excessive amount of water that's in short supply almost everywhere in the United States for these wells. And we also know that if there's a leakage into a larger aquifer, you can't clean that out. So, but where is the environmental movement to stop gas or hydrofracking? It's not there. Where's the environmental movement to clean up the major toxic sites? I don't see it. So I'd like to know why the American public, the American media, principally the official left, has not been honest about the complete failure of the major environmental groups to address any of our serious issues in this dog and pony show of carbon trading. And also, why hasn't someone had an honest conversation publicly with Al Gore upon how much money he's made by profiting from going commercially green? I'd like your thoughts on these, please.
Well, there's a carefully cultivated myth in this country that the environmental groups are actually protecting the environment. However, when you actually have those honest conversations with them, they say, well, of course things are better now than they were before, and they point to the fact that rivers don't catch on fire anymore, to which we usually say, well, we're in a world of hurt if we're measuring the success of our environmental laws by the fact that rivers don't catch on fire anymore. I think the issue that you raise is an important one, but I would reframe it slightly, which is, why don't the people who would be adversely impacted by the reactor explosion or the reactor shutdown in this circumstance, why don't they have the right as a locality to actually close down a project or reactor that is going to harm them in the future, leaving aside the fact that it's harming them now? It's not just the radioactive water coming out from the reactors, it's also elevating temperature in these areas, which also does ecological damage. Nuclear power can't be operated in an ecologically sustainable way. The two are incompatible. And so we need to be shutting those plants down. And in addition to that, stopping the federal government's drive to put new plants in. Yet the system has very carefully insulated communities from the actual decision-making authority that they need to move forward in those areas. And what we do is assist communities to seize that power anyway. So it would mean a binding initiative in the communities around Indian Point to actually take the authority of municipal governments and slam it up against the federal authority to drive these reactors and other operating projects that are nuke-related into these communities. And so I don't think there's no mystery here. There's no jigsaw puzzle that needs to be reinvented. The problem is that the environmental groups have no interest in taking on the nuke plants because a lot of them have now begun to embrace nuclear as a way to get around global warming concerns. And so those are not the folks that are going to lead the charge to shut down the nuclear industry in the United States. The only folks that are going to lead the charge to shut down the nuclear industry are the folks that are directly and imminently affected by those plants if something goes wrong. And it's there where the decision-making authority has to vest. And so what's interesting to me about your story, which we've heard hundreds of times before, is it doesn't matter that the science is on our side. It doesn't matter that you turn out 2,000 people to a rally. It doesn't matter that it's reasonable to ask the questions that you're asking and raise those concerns. It's that the system of law that we have does not recognize the authority of people who live in those communities to actually decide their future in 20, 40, or 60 years about actually closing these plants down. And so that's the overriding issue. Why is it that we don't have local community self-government in the United States? Why is it that that power has been divested from us and given to others who are a relatively small number of people who now have the legal authority to override community majorities? Because at least in our opinion, we will not reach sustainability without true local democracy. And without that true local democracy component, we can have the rallies, we can enlist the media, we can do all the things that our traditional environmental activism has taught us to do, but it won't matter because there's no correlation between that activity and actually having decision-making authority to actually take the steps to stop what is harming us or what is going to harm us in the future.
I appreciate those insights. Those are truths that may be painful, but we need to see. Finally, would you give us your solutions on how we can take back the power that these major corporations, these major nonprofits have, and let the small grassroots participation at the community level begin to have a voice of their own and work within their community? And also, I believe we should be doing more exposés on the money that ALEC spends and how they're able to influence legislation, especially polluters legislation in states behind closed doors, where about 400 to 500 major corporations meet regularly about twice a year with state legislators and say, here are the laws you're going to pass, here's the laws you're going to take away. None of that helps the citizens in that state or in that community, almost always works against them, and yet those legislators don't have a decency or strength of character to stand up and say, how dare you ask me to come to a meeting with you and eviscerate some laws because they don't benefit you, and that's wrong. You didn't elect us to office, the citizens of this state. Remember, one vote, one citizen? And you don't see that. You don't see it anywhere. You become concerned that our entire body politic, with few exceptions like Bernie Sanders or Dennis Kucinich, have been bought out, and therefore they're not representing, and they're not going to represent us. So how then do you deal with that when you have the truth, you have the science, you have the grassroots support, you have the imminent danger, and yet they have bought the politicians who control the legislature and the governors, and they dictate, and they also control the media. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, it's been going on long before we had ALEC that this was the situation, but eventually it means taking a tough look at the U.S. Constitution, because our constitutional structure in this country is all about protecting and enabling the endless production of more stuff. And so when communities arise to actually say no, they're standing in the way of that endless production. And so we have very root structural problems in the United States. We have a document that was written in the 1790s to, in essence, exploit natural resources as quickly as possible to build a nation state as the United States. And so our roots go all the way back to that point in time. It's so easy for ALEC to do what they do because constitutional rights and powers have been accumulated in the corporate form over the past 200 years. And without fundamental change to the constitutional structure, we're kind of screwed. And so the answer to that is that we need to build a movement in the United States that becomes powerful enough to make constitutional change. And it has to be built independently of these environmental organizations and all the other institutions that have grown up across the past 200 years to actually help that corporate form do what it needs to do. And that's the basis and focus of our work, is how do you build 10,000 communities who begin to frontally challenge the authority of federal and state governments to actually override them in the name of the corporation? And how do you give birth to a new civil and environmental rights movement that eventually changes state and federal constitutions?
Thomas, thank you very much for the good work you're doing out there. You are a beacon for us. People can go to your website. It is celdf.org, celdf.org. The book is by Thomas Lindsey with L-I-N-Z-E-Y. He's in Spokane, Washington, and it's Be the Change. So all the best. We look forward to continuing dialoguing on this topic, Thomas.
Yes, thanks for having us on the show, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you who've just joined us. I'm Gary Nall. We've just been speaking with Thomas Lindsey. Now let's go over and say hello to Derek Jensen in Northern California. I gave you Derek's background a little earlier in the program. Nice to have you with us today, Derek.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
Derek, I have a few issues. Let me post them up front and then take your time and offer us your insights on each one, all right?
Great.
I'm concerned that our mainstream environmental movements, those leaders who position themselves to always be the spokespersons for whatever is green in America, I believe that they have done a very poor job. And with either with intent to help their own organizations themselves or not, the results are that I don't see we have an environmental movement today. And let me just give you one example. Recently, we marched to Washington to challenge the Congress and the President to stop supporting genetically modified organisms and to support local organic food. None showed up. We have been championing the cause against hydrofracking. One of many, we're working collectively together. None showed up. We're going against nuclear all across the United States. We brought Helen Caldicott and Carl Grossman and many others to New York. When inviting them, none came, none even responded. When we held demonstrations in Manhattan and in Prospect Park and at Indian Point, none showed. Yet thousands upon thousands of just regular people who care about the environment did show up, have written letters. We're writing articles and letters. So where is this environmental group that have the tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of dollars? What are they doing for this environmental movement? I'm concerned. I'm also concerned, as I mentioned a few moments ago to Thomas, that I see no greater threat to all people and the environment in the United States than a Fukushima in the United States. We have 104 potential Fukushimas. A, many are made by the same manufacturers with the same design. B, many are on earthquake faults, the most dangerous earthquake fault in the United States as far as the research is Indian Point, just about 38 miles north of New York City. Nothing is being done by these groups who could use their power, their PR connections, to make this a major story. They're missing in action. And yet, anytime the New York Times or Washington Post, when I talk about the environment, they always show up on television. We never get the call. Those who are out there, Harvey Wasserman, he could debate and win any debate on nuclear power. So could Michio Kaku. Why aren't these people invited to the forum? Instead, it's the same people over and over again. They're the ones who go before Congress. So I have to ask us this basic question. Do we even have an environmental movement in the United States from that perspective? And next, my last point is this, and then I'll keep quiet and take your time. I believe that no organization in the United States is capable of being reformed. No paradigm shift. I do not believe that Marilyn Ferguson, with her aquarian conspiracy concept, that if enough people get into a certain mindset, that the entire paradigm shifts, including the corporations. I've never seen that. I don't believe it's possible. I believe that we must have a breakdown completely until we can then have a breakthrough. So many of us are actually hoping President Obama is elected. Many of us are hoping that things actually stay the way they are for a period of time, because the absolute corruption, the hubris, the arrogance, the conceit, the massive manipulation of the media and the people and the voters is not even being hidden anymore. Unless you're brain dead, you got to realize that you, the American public, don't count at all. And so therefore, let them, whether we like it or not, go ahead with their massive power plays, destroy everything in their wake, and then maybe, just maybe, about 50% of the American population who are choosing to be ignorant, indifferent, distracted, will wake up and say, what just happened? Why wasn't I informed? Your thoughts, please.
Well, thank you for all that analysis, and there's a lot of stuff there. And let's see. I'll see if I can move through this. I don't know if I'm going to remember and respond to everything you said, because there was so much there, but I'll do what I can. Part of it having to do with the large environmental organizations has to do with part of the problem is that a lot of the mainstream environmentalists and the big environmentalists are really explicit about what they're attempting to save, and they are not attempting to save wildlife or wild species or wild places. They're pretty explicit that they're attempting to save capitalism. They don't question capitalism. And you hear this, a great example of this would be Peter Montague, who's just great. I love his work. He's done great work on toxics forever. And he talks about why carbon sequestration is a bad idea. And one of the things he says is that carbon sequestration, the idea of not doing it naturally where you allow prairies to sequester carbon, but instead pumping carbon way into the earth. And he says it's a bad idea because if it leaks out, it could, quote, disrupt civilization as we know it. It's like, no, Peter, actually could end life on earth. And we see the same thing with Bill McKibben. Bill McKibben has done a wonderful job of, he has probably more than anyone else raised awareness about global warming, and that's really great. But at the same time, he talks about the reason we need to stop global warming is not to preserve the oceans, is not to preserve life on Earth, but instead to preserve this way of life. And this is really problematic. And this is what I see in, you know, National Wildlife Federation. This is what I see in all the big so-called green organizations, is that they're really about preserving this way of life. They're not really about preserving the natural world. That doesn't even enter into the discussion for the most part. They don't question that. And this is really problematical, because if you don't, just very briefly, Robert J. Lifton wrote this great book called The Nazi Doctors. And central to the book was, he was asking the question, how did people go to work in Nazi death camps who had taken the Hippocratic Oath? You know, doctors would go in and they would work at a death camp. How can that happen? And what he found is actually many of the doctors would do everything that they could to help the inmates. Everything they could, not Mengele. Mengele was really horrible. But many of them were actually quite good people, would go in, they would do whatever they could. They would give them the inmates an extra scrap of potato to eat. They would hide them from the selection officer going to kill them. They would put them to bed for a day or two. They would do everything, and here's the point, except for the most important thing of all, which is they would never question the existence of the death camp. They would never question the framing conditions that lead to this. And this is like, I mean, on a personal level, this would be like doing some extremely dangerous activity again and again, and then wondering, you know, some activity, okay, doing some activity, you know, I don't know, smoking, and then wondering why you get cancer, continuing to do some behavior without questioning that underlying behavior. And it's the same thing with the large environmental organizations. Part of it is that they don't question capitalism. They don't question a growth economy. You know, it's like Al Gore with An Inconvenient Truth, that all the solutions that he presented in the film, were all personal. He didn't talk about corporate power at all. And so the whole thing, we see this all the time with a lot of these movies or books or any of these so-called solutions, is they will talk about the problem, but then at the end they will contradict themselves because they're ignoring corporate power, ignoring a growth economy. So, for example, Al Gore, once again, an inconvenient truth, if every person in the United States did all of the personal solutions that he suggests, that would only reduce carbon emissions by about 22%, which, A, would be insufficient, and, B, since he doesn't question a growth economy, at the economy growing at 2 or 3% per year, that would simply lead to those emissions being back up where they were in 10 years or so. So they don't question those foundations. That's one problem. Another problem is that, and I don't know if you've mentioned this earlier, but there are people from really nasty corporations on the boards of directors, they're directors on the boards of many of the large environmental organizations, and there's a revolving door between them. A famous case of this was Jay Hare, who ran the National Wildlife Federation for years. As soon as he left the National Wildlife Federation, he became a PR flack for Plum Creek Timber Company, which is such a nasty timber company that even Republicans called it the Darth Vader of the timber industry. So these people are just moving back and forth between, it's kind of like Panetta. They're just basically career bureaucrats who it doesn't really matter whether they're running the National Wildlife Federation or whether they're running, you know, in Panetta's case, he never did the Wildlife Federation, I'm not saying that, but Panetta ran some pseudo-environmental organization. Now what, isn't Panetta in charge of the CIA? And it doesn't matter, they're just running bureaucracy. And the third
Secretary
I want to
Defense,
mention,
he was the head of the CIA, and instead, the head of the CIA is General Petraeus. Now that's an interesting pick, a pro-warmonger who heads now all of our nationals' foreign intelligence agencies.
Well, yes, and that's problematical on its own level. So back to the big organizations. Another part of the problem is, and I'm going to totally butcher this quote, but Back in the days of Teddy Roosevelt, there was a it might have even been before, but anyway, back around the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries, the railroad companies were horrible monopolies, and they were very dangerous, and they were really nasty in basically every way, and the they were also good friends with the president and. And it was the same as today in terms of just a revolving door between corporations and politics. And they were going to set up the Interstate Commerce Commission because there was basically going to be a revolution because the railroad companies were so horrible. And so they set up the ICC, and ahead of one of the railroad companies wrote to his buddy, who was basically Secretary of Treasury or whatever, and said, "This is terrible. How could you possibly set up a commission to oversee us?" And the guy said, "Don't worry. The whole point of this is to make the public think that there is a buffer between you and the government. The whole point of this is to basically soak off any outrage that people would have against you." And another way to say this is that the purpose of the ICC was so that people would believe, oh, things are going to be okay because someone is actually taking care of this. And we can say the same thing about the large capitalist environmental, in quotes, organizations, that one of the functions they serve is to let people think, well, somebody must be doing something about it, so things are going to be okay. And that's a way to really soak off the outrage that many people will have, will think that someone is protecting us. I mean, the same thing happens, frankly, with the police, that we think, oh, well, the police are here to protect us. But the truth is that only 6% of rapists, for example, ever spend one night in jail. And so there's a sense in which there's actually, you know, most of the, they're not doing a tremendously good job of protecting us in that way. And that actually brings up another thing, and then I'll shut up on this. But I was doing a benefit several years ago for a community in New Mexico that was a poor, they were poor, and they were primarily people of color, and they were attempting to keep a toxic dump out of their community, and the dump was going to be, they were going to bring in electronic crap or whatever from somewhere else and dump it in that community. And the entire community was against it, and they were just getting rolled over by the state and federal governments. And the police were arresting them. And we started having this conversation about, me and the people from the community started having this conversation about, wow, what would happen if police started to support the dictates of distant economic entities, distant corporations and distant governments, but instead started to enforce cancer-free zones? What would happen if the police really did that? And then we just started laughing because, of course, that's not really the primary job of the police. And then we started saying, what if we in our communities started to enforce cancer-free zones? And we say in our community, you are not going to have a toxic waste dump in our community. And this gets back to what Thomas was saying about communities within this system. Communities do not have local autonomy at all, really, in that sense. And so what this would look like is, the question really is, what would it look like if we started having militias that were enforcing cancer-free zones or enforcing Walmart-free zones or enforcing corporate hog farm-free zones or, you know, we can pick your favorite atrocity that you want to stop, rape-free zones for that matter. And because, honestly, the government is not set up to protect us from corporations. The government is set up to protect corporations from us. And so we in our communities need to figure out ways to do that. And so that's my sort of quick 3 or 4 point response to a bunch of the things you said. And I'm sure there's many other great things you said that I've forgotten because I'm getting to be middle-aged.
That's fine. You're doing terrific, and we all appreciate your insights. Let's take them one at a time. Today, genetically modified seed protester shut down California Monsanto office. There were only a couple dozen of people, not thousands, not hundreds, but they shut down the entire office for the day out near Monsanto's California office in Davis, California, near Sacramento. Why is it that we have not seen any of the heads and the active leadership of the major organizations out there advocating doing the same? I've yet to see them coming forward nationally and saying, A, we're going to do a sit-in at the corporate headquarters of name the company. Like the military, the number one polluter in the world is the U.S. military. And B, we're asking for a boycott of all the products that they create. We haven't seen that from any of these organizations. And also, Jeffrey Smith is a person that believes very much in working within the system. Others do. I do not believe we can work within the system. I believe the moment you work within the system and you get these rewards, you cease being objective. And I just believe that we have to be far more in their face about that they're not going to change. They have no intent to change. But I think that they think that we're so weak that as long as they dangle money in from us or you know, funding for our groups, we'll say, okay, you know, it's not so bad. Let's go along with it. How do you see this? Like the National Resource Defense Council and the Sierra Club and the largest corporate polluters receiving corporate monies in exchange for supporting their so-called green faux stamp of approval for purposes of public image.
Well, I really like what you said here and what you said a little while ago about you don't think there's going to be a sort of paradigm shift and that there needs to be a breakdown. And I completely agree with that. And that's, I think another part of the problem, there's a great line by Upton Sinclair. It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I would say also that it's hard to make people, I would sort of translate that to, it's hard to make people understand something when their privilege depends on them not understanding it. And I think for me, I mean, one of the things that's always been clear to me about your work is that your primary loyalty is to the victims of this way of life. And it seems to me that the first step in figuring out what we should do is to, it's like so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things that means to me is we have to figure out where our loyalty lies. And you know, I'm pretty clear that my loyalty lies with the salmon and with the hummingbirds and the wood ducks and the Pacific tree frogs and the red-legged frogs. And that was the point I was trying to make earlier about how a lot of the big green organizations, their primary loyalty is to capitalism and is to the Sierra Club. It is to the organization. It's not actually to the wild ones. And part of the problem, part of the reason for that, I think, really is privilege, because nobody wants to really, I mean, it's just sort of a standard progression that we see in a lot of resistance movements, that you start off by petitioning the king, and then that doesn't work. So, or you start off by, you know, talking to the bad people and saying, please don't do this, and that doesn't work. So you try petitioning the king, and that doesn't work. And then you keep escalating until finally you find something that works. And we can see this through the civil rights movement. We can see this through the Irish struggle against British imperialism. We can see this in India. You know, Monsanto is what actually made me think of this line of thought right now, because in India, you know, they've burned Monsanto offices. And part of the reason they're doing this is because many of the people involved don't have the luxury of attempting to solely appeal to the government, but instead their very lives are dependent upon stopping Monsanto. And I think that for a lot of us, one of the reasons that we don't resist a lot more is because it's very easy within this system to either get distracted, wow, isn't March Madness great, or to we also forget that things are really bad because there's still food in the grocery stores. And so it's really easy to pretend that the world isn't being murdered before our eyes. How could it be murdered? How could, you know, there's 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. But how could that possibly be true when you can still get tuna for your cats? You know, how could the oceans be harmed if I can still go down and buy?
Derek, are you there? I think we might have lost. Oh, was Derek discontinued there? Did he drop off? We'll try to get him back on. I absolutely concur with Derek. I believe that we have to decide what we're loyal to, and if loyalty is to our own self-preservation, that of our organization, and I'm opposed almost all, not about 90% of all the nonprofit organizations, because I find that almost all their energy goes into supporting their own continuity and very little actually gets to the ground. I want to get him back on because I believe that what's missing in the entire environmental movement is any sense of democracy. It was Harry Emerson Fosdick who said that democracy is based upon the conviction that there are extraordinary possibilities in ordinary people. Then where are ordinary people? They have to stand forward. But it was Harry Truman, former President of the United States, after FDR and before Eisenhower, said democracy is based upon the conviction that man has the moral and intellectual capacity, as well as the inalienable right to govern himself with reason and justice. So when you look at what Truman said, listen again. Democracy is based on the conviction that man has the moral and intellectual capacity as well as the inalienable right to govern himself with reason and justice. Yet today, with the Patriot Act, with Homeland Security Act, with the Defense Appropriations Act, with all the other intelligence agencies, with the massive scramble to get every dollar they can from the American public through all these funding of the military-industrial spy complex, we're led to believe that we do not have the capacity to reason and to commit justice in our life. We are only to be vessels. We're to be told what to do by people like airport security that frisk a three-year-old boy who had a leg cast on. And the boy was confused and crying. They wouldn't let his mother even go to him. You know, this is insane to be sexually groped in an airport, and that's acceptable. But out on the street, they would go to jail, and rightly so for that. So when did we abrogate our responsibility to be reasonable and justice in our own right? Because we have an inalienable right. Well, our inalienable right's been taken away, so too has our environment. Don't worry about the environment. because all the polluters know that nothing you and I say will make a difference to them because they worry about the politicians. They control the media. They can control the argument and the dialogue. And now with Alec and the other groups, they're controlling the laws that allow them to pollute. They're watering down. It started under Clinton and Gore. They watered down, threw away a lot of the laws. So where then is this democracy that we can know what we should be for, and we have the moral and intellectual capacity to choose for the environment, to choose for nature, for you, Derek, to choose for the salmon and the hummingbirds and anything else you want, or all of us to work together when it clearly is absolutely opposite what anyone in positions of power are suggesting? Your final thoughts.
I think that one of the things that a lot of, you know, maybe another time we can have a whole conversation about this, that I've been writing a lot lately. I think that one of the fundamental problems that we face is human supremacism, which is the belief that humans are fundamentally separate from and superior to all others. And the reason I bring this up right now is because I think that a lot of the murder of the planet is being driven by this notion that we are separate from all the others, which doesn't really answer the question of the big greens. I know that's kind of off topic, but it's a huge and central problem. And what's even worse, and this does take us back to the big greens, is the belief that, that capitalism is superior and separate from, and the notion that you can have a democracy and nuclear power plants at the same time. And that's not really possible,
that's
because
a
nuclear power plants...
Complete myth.
I'm sorry?
That is a complete myth. You can't have both at the same time.
Yes, I completely agree. And because you have to have these autocratic social structures in order to maintain a military complex, in order to maintain nuclear power plants, they're fundamentally anti-democratic. And I guess that's what I would end with today.
One last question. Many people view Greenpeace, one of the largest environmental groups in the world, as the most, that has the most integrity. What are your thoughts about Greenpeace?
You know, actually, Greenpeace is a really good example of sort of the unnatural history of organizations like that. That it started off pretty good, and then it got worn down and turned and co-opted. And we see that with the Sierra Club. We saw that with the Sierra Club. A lot of these groups actually started off quite good, but as they became larger and more bureaucratized, they got either taken over or co-opted, or somehow they lost their edge. And we can see this in all sorts of organizations all the time. And in fact, it's pretty interesting. If we want to get into it, we could talk about how Christianity moved very quickly from the teachings of Jesus to an institution that was killing other people pretty quickly. And that's a movement that we see a lot as organizations ossify and as they forget their original meaning. You know, it's like that famous line about the Buddha's always killed on the road. You know, that quickly, as soon as the original people start to attempt to protect the organization instead of to put forward their original ideas, then everything starts going to crap pretty quickly. So Greenpeace, I would put like a step up from some of the really terrible big green organizations, but I don't have a lot of faith in Greenpeace either.
Derek, thank you very much for taking your time and sharing this with us. We appreciate your insights.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your work.
And Derek's newest book is, he has many writings, including End Games and also Dreams, his critique against the fundamentalist Christian legalist morality and materialistic way that they go about defining Western civilization. And also, I want to thank Professor Thomas Lindsay for being with us today on our Progressive Commentary Hour. Now, we're going to, you can watch it if you have the video capacity. You can listen to it. Last year, I was invited over to the UN to be the keynote speaker. And a little context. I've been intimately involved in the environmental movement for a long time. I've been concerned that the environmental organizations were not doing the work that they were mandated to do, and most people thought they were doing. And so when I get up before this packed group, mostly of environmental organization people, I had a choice. I could have said thank you, you know, for inviting me to speak, and, you know, done a little nice lecture for half hour and left. Or I could, you know, lay it on the line and risk them booing and getting up and marching out or whatever, which is absolutely their right. Listen to what come from this. This is that speech now.
First, I want to thank the good work that this wonderful foundation does. We frequently forget about the power of the individual. Though we have relegated so much of the achievements of any movement to single individuals, it's always the collective. It is the we in the future that is going to make a difference. When I was first speaking at Earth Day in 1990, it was in Dallas, Texas, and I had an epiphany. I had written some things I thought they would find of interest, but there were thousands and thousands of people in Dallas. And there was good music, and I'm walking around, and I'm talking with people. And one of the guys said, what are you going to talk about? I'm going to say about how we should challenge globalization. And he said, I'm for it. Let's get that message out. And then I stopped, and I said, you're eating McDonald's, you're drinking Coca-Cola, you're smoking Lucky Strikes, you've got Calvin Klein jeans, Tommy Hilfiger shirt, someone else's hat, someone else's sunglasses, and Nike sneakers. What part of globalization are you against? And as I walked through the group, it was just one big litter. I've never seen that much litter, environmental refuge, at any place, let alone Earth Day. So it taught me something. Now, I believe that one individual makes a difference. In fact, every important act in history, every act started with one person, not a group, not a committee, one human being who had the courage to say, let me challenge something. I believe that we have to have a new direction. I believe if we do not have dynamic new energies involved in this effort, working together, coming from their own unique individuality, but sharing that with others cooperatively, that we will not be where we need to be. Here is the problem. First, I'll show you the bad news, and please understand, I'm going to show you the good news. Because the bad news, in my opinion, is really bad. And I believe until we can look honestly in the mirror of who we've become as a movement, the environmental movement, and why we're allowing the Democrats and Republicans to hold the arguments, and we shouldn't, because both the Democrats and the Republicans, as entire parties, have become corporatized. And we all know that. Not every person. There are a few Republicans and a few Democrats who still hold individual idealistic principles. But by and large, they have controlled, well, global warming doesn't exist. Hello? Global warming? That's one issue. I'm doing a documentary as we speak on the 12 tipping points. I produce films. Drugging of Our Children, Fatal Fallout, Autism Made in USA. I've done over 100 films. This has taken me a long time because I'm having to show the problem and the solution. Right now, three of the 12 tipping points are going to tip no matter what anyone does. When we keep hearing about the hottest record, the coldest record, the record flooding, no one starts asking, how many records do we have in a year? And why doesn't anyone connect these? In which states can't you even sustain a future because it doesn't have enough water? And do we think about buying Fiji water, how far it took for that water to get here, as if we're being conscientious about the selection we make? We're not. And partly it's because we no longer have a viable environmental movement. Now, I say that not to challenge those who are doing good work. I say because we have allowed the environmental movement to become branded, no different than any other brand. It has been compromised, co-opted, and completely assaulted, but done so in such a stealth manner that I cannot trust any environmental group any longer to tell me the unbiased truth. Let me give you one example. By the way, this is the book in 1990, Clearer, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, Blueprint for a New Environment. Here were the hot issues that I thought we would really be able to focus on and do something about. Global warming, back then, genetic engineering of food, the Terminator seeds, pesticides explosion, the Dirty Dozen, the war on our air, the philosophy of food, fake and denatured and adulterated foods, the politics of food, the American Council on Science and Health, which is pro-industry, the irradiation of foods, nuclear waste, our nuclear mythology, which I would later do about low-level radiation. Oh, there's no harm in low-level radiation. I've done 3 award-winning documentaries on the Gulf War veterans coming back. 400,000 are sick with Gulf War syndrome. None of that is post-traumatic stress disorder. That's a separate disorder. Almost 30,000 have been reported dying because of this, and yet not one article anywhere in the American media about 400,000 dying what? Depleted uranium. Now, if it's hurting the GIs because it's in the shells and the casings, what about every time one of those bombs exploded in Iraq? Now, in my film, and it took me 4 months to smuggle my film out of Iraq because of the censorship. NBC, CBS, Fox News, oh, Fox News, what, pro-war? No, they don't have anything. Someone like myself? No, you couldn't get my film footage out. We had to sneak it out through Norway. But in my footage, I show you a field the size of a football field with dead babies. I show you why, not from bullets, but from depleted uranium. Cyclops baby, one eye in the middle of the head. Children born with no brains. One kid, 3 heads. Now, what would the American public do if they saw a 3-headed baby due to depleted uranium and the doctor in the hospital saying we're getting 3 dead kids a day in this hospital? We never got 3 dead kids a year from these diseases before this invasion using this. Not one word. That's the power. We're the environmental groups of talking about we've created an entire dead zone, 3 billion years, the half-life of that depleted uranium, to get out of there. It's in the soil, it's in the sand, it's in the water, and it's hurting people. Women are all over Iraq are told don't have babies because you're going to end up with the defects, and every family knows about defects. But do we concern ourselves? No. Where's our churches? Where's our church leaders? Where's the environmental groups? I don't ask anyone in Congress. I wouldn't trust them to touch this issue because they wouldn't. They'll deny it. So that's why I'm concerned. Who's on the side of the Gulf War veterans? How about no one? They're not getting treatment. They're denied that their cancers, their rare conditions are due to the war. Why? Because someone would have to pay for it and someone would have to acknowledge it. The anthrax vaccines, the botulism vaccines that were experimental with adjuvants, that's all environmental. We're doing nothing about it. That's just one example. Now, all the issues I talked about then are exactly where we are today. So I decided, how aware are we of our environmental impact outside of global warming? Yes, no. It exists, it doesn't exist. Glenn Beck, it's a, you know, the communist, the Marxist, and the socialist. Gee, Glenn, you're against socialism? Yeah, and so is Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, and of course, Ann Coulter. She thinks all of us who are actually progressive are godless. Remember her best-selling book, Godless Liberals? Gee, Ann, read Christ. He was a progressive. How do you wrap your mind around the fact that Jesus was godless? Only a Republican do that. I'll tell you that. Man, what hypocrisy. So then I say, if you're against global warming and what it means, you're tying global warming into socialism, communism, anti-business. What if the police come to your house because there's a robbery? You're going to say, hold on, do I have insurance? Your neighbor's house is burning. Do you call and stop and say, hold on, you can't put out that fire unless they have insurance? Well, our public schools, our fire department, our police department, our emergency room hospital, that is public assistance. And yet they'll deny the benefit of that. So who comes into the scene? These people, and their sponsor comes in. An article last week, an article in The Nation magazine. I'm going to read you just one quote. This is why you got to pay attention to the environmental movement. And I knew the environmental movement was going to hell when on Fridays in the Washington Clinton administration, I'd see environmental leaders playing football with the vice president. Okay? I wish Tubby was here. I'd have a debate with him. You want to really do something about global warming? Why don't you become a vegan? If you became a vegan, you would do more to reduce global warming than all the cars, planes, trains, buses, and ships. Just shifting, as I am, to a vegan diet. Buy locally. This morning I was down at the farmer's market buying my produce. Local, organic, sustainable farming. Is that a sin? Is that something we can't agree upon? Is that reasonable, unreasonable? to buy locally grown food, to say no to Whole Foods, health food store that buys this genetically engineered material out of China and calls it organic? On the front, organic. Look on the back. Look on the back. Product of China. Nice when you're a multi-billion-dollar corporation. Now you can say green. No, you want to go green? Go local, 100% organic. Enough supply? You bet. Let me quote this. This is from one example of why we should be concerned. Christine McDonald, an idealistic young environmentalist, discovered how deeply this cash and transformation of these institutions, being the environmental institutions, when she started to work for Conservation International. She said, about a week or two after I started, I went to a big planning meeting of all the organization's media teams, and they started talking about this supposedly great new project they were running with British Petroleum. But I had read in the newspaper the day before that the EPA had condemned British Petroleum for running the most polluting plant in the whole country. But nobody at this meeting or anywhere else in the organization wanted to talk about it. It was a taboo. You weren't supposed to talk as if British Petroleum was really anything but green. They were helping us, meaning giving us money, lots of money. She said soon, she explains that this was common across all mainstream green organizations. They take money and in turn they offer praise, even when the money comes from the companies causing environmental devastation. And then it gives examples of IKEA and others. What's my issue here? My issue is that as long as we allow the Democrats and Republicans and their talking heads and foundations out there to do the important work, then we lose responsibility. We lost control of a movement. I'm tired of hearing the hypocrites bring out movies to tell you about global warming and then flying on a private jet and owning livestock and not being solarized. My house is 100% solarized. I eat only green produce. I use drip systems. If I can do it, you can do it. If I'm sprouting 27 different types of heirloom seeds as sprouts, you could do it. If I say no to eating anything with a heartbeat or a face, you could do it. And if you choose to eat something with a heartbeat or a face, then eat your dog or cat first. All right? And if you're not willing to eat your dog and cat and share it with the neighbors, barbecue it, deep fry it, however you want it, then don't eat someone else's pet. Because I'm also a farmer. I'm a certified organic farmer. And I can tell you that the intelligence, the passion, the gentleness of every animal that you would think is all right for eating are my pets. If I went into a field and I said, Clara, suddenly one cow out of 30 will come over to me. That's Clara. And she'll give me kisses. All right? Who would want to eat Clara? Well, everyone eating a McDonald's, eating up to 1,000 different cows in one. You won't find hardwood furniture because I don't want to see any more devastation of the rainforest. I want to see you can buy almost anything you have in leather in now natural materials that look like leather, feel like leather, but are natural. Don't buy bottled water. Buy filters and filter your water. All right? Be conscientious. So when you as individuals and I as an individual work collectively together and we say, well, we're a tiny little percentage of the population. We're about 5%. 5%. That's 15 million people. You give me 15 million people standing up for something, and I'll show you 15 million people that can cause change. Remember, the empowered minority always will get more done than the disempowered majority. So look at the power you have. I'm also tired that our senior citizens have not joined together and collectively protested the treatment of senior citizens. First, because I do not believe in the nature of forced retirement. Secondly, I do not believe in the perversion of your second death. The first death you die is easy. You cease. The second death, however, is far more painful. You no longer are irrelevant. And I believe that no one should ever be considered irrelevant because of their age. I believe that the older you get, the wiser you are, the more significant you are, the greater your capacity to help others, the more humane you are. You've been there, you've done it, so therefore you know what it feels like, and you know what it would be like to be on the other end of a kind thought. And think of all the resources we have, the human resources that we're not using. If we want to do something for this society to put workers back to work, do not allow another stimulus plan. The fraud of the, if you want to hear my specific points, I just did coup d'etat in America on my radio show this week. Go to GaryNoll.com, you can listen to it, where I name the names of how, quietly, completely legally, through financial institutions, they have virtually corrupted all major institutions. They have corporatized and commodified everything, all the while saying it's for the public good. Then show me how many people got money, the average citizen, the small business person. What do we do for our environment or helping our infrastructures? We're collapsing. Nothing. Zero. But Goldman Sachs? Yeah. Now, a gentleman made an interesting comment over at the bell ringing when he talked about we've got to be aware of what's happening with two things on water. First, right now there is no such thing as a clean drop of water in the United States coming out of any public service because they cannot filter out medicines at the nano level. You're getting heart medications, AIDS medications, cancer medications, tranquilizers in your drinking water. Fact. A very serious situation is that virtually every major governmental agency has people appointed who come from the very industries that we should be concerned about. And I'm concerned about this. Let me give you an example of two things we should be talking about every day in blogging. One, why can't the President of the United States, along with members of Congress, pass a law outlawing, banning, trading in commodities essential to life? Water, fuel, and food. Goldman Sachs, by itself, was able to take the price of oil from $47 to $147 in 1 year. There was no ship because of supply and demand. The cost of crude is about $10 to $12 a gallon or a barrel. Could you imagine what it was costing by the time these people manipulated? Hundreds of millions of dollars of profit per week, and yet think of the poor people who couldn't afford to heat their whole home because between medicine and food and fuel, they couldn't do it all. So therefore, think how many people, without anyone knowing it, had to turn the temperature off and in cold climates. Those people on Wall Street getting that money, they didn't think about you as a human being because they have ceased being the we. They are part of that greed is good philosophy that came in the 1980s and 90s and is here today, but it's got virtually control. That's one thing we can do. Secondly, we can also oppose globalization. You can't show me a country in the world where globalization has improved the quality of life for the average person. And until such time that we fight back against globalization, and how do we do that? You can do three things immediately. Positive. A, take all your money and finance and savings out of all the top banks and put them into credit unions, of which there are over 6,500, or small savings loan banks. Get out of the commercial market. When you do that, 40% of their income evaporates because there's two economies. There's the Wall Street economy that makes money off money, where you do not benefit. No new jobs, no new factories, no improving the cost of living. And then there's the real economy, where the rest of the population lives. So when they told you if we didn't bail out the banks that were too big to fail, that the whole economy would have gone down, that is a lie. We would have been better off had these corporations gone out because their survival was only to allow them to continue in the casino gambling that they did with credit default swaps and derivatives. Now, these are the people that will play currencies. They'll play on wheat and soybeans. And also, let's get out of this notion of biofuels. That's a complete and total environmental fraud. And yet, are you aware how many acres are set aside that could be used to grow food for humans that are growing corn and soybeans for ethanol? And when you do the actual math, there is no advantage. So do not support ethanol. Pull your money out of banks. Become a vegan. It's healthy.
Well, that was the talk at the UN. And I'm invited back to the UN this June, and I'll be back giving another presentation. If you'd like to call in now and share your thoughts on any of the things we've discussed in this program this evening, please do so. Our number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And if we get some calls, we'll stick around for a few more moments and hear your points of view. If not, then if Richard Gale is in the office, we will speak with him. I wanted to get an idea of some of the topics that we're going to be covering, which are some very important ones, we always try to take on the topics that most people don't handle. And for whatever reason they choose, they go with the more topical, like who's winning in a particular state in popularity, as if that's relevant. It's irrelevant. These are important issues. I'm traveling in the United States now for approximately 10 weeks. Every day, I'm going to be filming, interviewing, this time senior citizens, to see how they're coping or not, and what they have to say about the world we live in, our body politic, at the state level, the federal level. And these are people who in mass have not protested, in mass have not gathered, who have no major advocates out there now. But there's a lot of them. If they ever got together and decided to do some boycotting, they could make a difference. And I hope that they will. And I'm not sure if Richard Gale, let me just see if Richard's not answering, so that means that he is out. So we have no calls at this moment, so I'm hopeful that you all have appreciated the information. Every Monday evening, 7 to 8 o'clock, the Progressive Radio Hour will share insights on important topics. Next week, very important, it'll be the end of what we know now as water, oil, and food. They're all past their maximum point of extrapolation and exploitation. We are past peak oil, peak water, and peak food. What does that mean for all of us? Well, it's kind of hard to imagine, since you can go outside Manhattan or any of the boroughs and find markets willing to sell you everything from all over the world and here. But don't be deceived by that. Because if you're where I'm at, you see people are starving. You see children eating rats. You see people, senior citizens, opening up a cupboard in their kitchen and showing you 20 cans of cat food that they're eating. It's amazing, the oasis that New York and L.A. are, Manhattan and L.A., and how absolutely disconnected from the reality the rest of the world is. That'll be next Monday's show. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for watching and listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.